You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 370, Revelation 6. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I had my first fantasy baseball draft last week, Trey, and I'm relatively happy. Looks good.
So this is something I can get behind our audience, you know, being annoyed at us.
I'm not going to belabor it. I'm just teasing.
I'm teasing. How'd you do in the draft?
I think I did pretty well. You know, yeah. It's a roto league, so we'll see. Now I get to just see and watch which guys get injured.
Yeah.
That's my fantasy experience right there.
Well, the time of this recording, it's actually March Madness weekend, you know, the time of this recording. So I'm excited because my Texas Tech made it and Abilene Christian University made it. ACU made it. So ACU is going to play Texas tomorrow as the time of this recording. So by the time this is out, you know, we're already going to know the end of all of this.
But yeah, I forgot all about that because I don't watch basketball. But yeah.
I'm excited for Abilene Christian.
I don't even know who's supposed to win.
Gonzaga is number one overall.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, well, I've been on their campus once, so I guess I have a connection since they're in the Northwest.
What were you doing on their campus?
There was a regional SBL meeting on their campus one year. I went out and gave a paper and did what you do at regional meetings, you know, walk around and listen to stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So it's my experience, you know.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
At least I was there.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And we were talking about sports memorabilia before, and my son on his, he just turned 12 a few weeks ago, and my parents gave him an autographed Emmitt Smith jersey. So I asked him, I was like, hey, you want to keep that in my office? And of course, that didn't go down well, so... You know, I didn't get anything right. Like that. You know, we were talking. I didn't get anything like that for my birthday.
Yeah. Hey, mom and dad, why did you like waste your retirement? You know,
exactly.
On your grandson, you could have done that on me. You know,
exactly. I'm your son. I don't get anything. So I'm looking at an autographed Emmitt Smith. We haven't hung it up yet. So I'm looking at it, and it's giving me good vibes here. Especially since we're about you know, go down to the talk about the four horsemen here coming up.
Yeah, there you go. We'll accept that as a segue. How's that?
Okay,
that's acceptable.
Okay,
that's a football reference and a Revelation reference. So
you're welcome.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and the good news we should add is that we're actually going to get through Revelation 6 in one episode. So there's no, you know, 2, 3, 4. You know, ad infinitum parts to this, you know, and, you know, I judge these things by, okay, you know, since the series is about the, you know, John's use of the Old Testament and Revelation, how much Old Testament stuff's going on in the passage? Can I get through that in one pass or not? So that's how we judge these things. And in this case, yeah, we can. Some of these things are going to be, you know, familiar from chapter 5, but the new stuff, you know, put in here, we're going to be able to do it. So I'm going to read to start off here, the first, you know, Revelation 6, 1 through 8, and that'll, you know, get us into what we need to do, at least as far as, you know, our beginning point, just to refresh everybody's memory. Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth. So that's the first eight verses. Obviously, there's some familiar things here. We've got the lamb. We've got the living creatures. Again, these cherubim sort of figures, you know, from earlier Revelation 4 and 5. We've got the reference to death and Hades. Again, that's back in Revelation 1 and Revelation 3. So there are a few familiar things here, but there's going to be at least one case we're going to note kind of a bit of a twist in what John is getting us to think about. But let's just start again with the obvious. The Lamb opened one of the seals in the first verse. Now, Bone in his commentary observes something kind of obvious at the beginning here. He says, since it's obviously very difficult to imagine a lamb opening a sealed scroll, like how would he do that without fingers and thumbs? It is possible, On says, that the figure of the lamb has subsequently been superimposed on an originally anthropomorphic figure. The group of four visions in 6:1-8 is structured by using the four cherubim, each of whom summons one of the four horsemen, which afflict the world with a variety of plagues, unquote. Now, this raises an interesting, but, you know, to be honest with you, it's not terribly important point about when John describes the lamb, is he actually looking at a lamb or is he using the word lamb to describe Jesus? Okay, like you know, I looked and the lamb that was slain and he's standing before God. Okay, this Revelation 5 language. I mean, it is possible, I would agree with On, it is possible that what John's actually looking at is Jesus, but he uses the language of the Lamb because John does that elsewhere. Again, if we have the same author here as in the Gospel, and we've sort of presumed that, you know, we have references to Jesus as the Lamb of God, okay, that takes away the sin of the world. You know, when John says that in John chapter 1, you know, at the Jordan there while he's baptizing, behold, the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world, okay, obviously he's referring to Jesus, and it's equally as obvious it's not a vision. I mean, that's a, you know, real-time, you know, boots-on-the-ground event. But it does create this question, especially when the lamb, you know, is doing things that, in this case, require fingers and thumbs. At least you would think that that's what's going on here. How else do you open a sealed scroll? Maybe the lamb just looked at it. Who knows? I mean, we're not told. But it at least opens the door, and commentators have, you know, gone back and forth, like, okay, what's John actually looking at? And as I just read in the On, quote, maybe the figure of the lamb has been subsequently superimposed on an originally anthropomorphic figure. The ultimate answer is who knows, okay? Because all we do have is the verbiage, the vocabulary. We have things that seem incongruent with the vocabulary, but hey, it's an apocalyptic vision. Kind of like dreams, you know, don't need to really conform to reality as we experience it. All right, so, you know, an apocalyptic vision may not need, you know, these sort of niceties either, but I thought I'd mention it because it is part of the discussion. Again, I don't think it's terribly important either way, but just, you know, we run into it right away. Now, Beale, when he opens his discussion of the chapter, he writes this. It's similar, but a few differences here. Revelation 6:1-8 is intended to show that Christ rules over such an apparently chaotic world and that suffering does not occur indiscriminately or by chance. That's actually going to be a fairly important thought. Because who holds the keys to death and Hades? That would be Jesus. It would be the risen Christ. We've had that in a previous episode. So keep that in the back of your mind. We'll get back to it. Beale writes, this section reveals, in fact, that destructive events are brought about by Christ for both redemptive and judicial purposes. The command for each of the four destructive horses and riders originates from the throne room where Christ, i.e. the Lamb, opens each seal. The cherubim around the throne issue commands to the horsemen in response to the opening of each seal. Only then do the horsemen wreak their havoc. So what Beale is doing here is he's linking the release of the apocalypse to the command by virtue of the opening of the seals of the Lamb. Jesus is the one that launches the war here. That's the bottom line, okay? And we often, you know, we don't think of Jesus like this. We don't think of the Lamb like this, frankly. And if you remember back in chapter 5 when we talked about the Lamb, the imagery works two ways. You know, we think of a Lamb as, you know, cute and harmless and skipping around the field and, oh, what a, you know, we think of the ewe lamb, you know, from, you know, the parable with Nathan and David, and you know how pathetic that is, and so on and so forth. And the lamb was a sacrificial victim, you know, in Old Testament culture, Jewish culture. But lamb imagery was also used of the gods and of rule and of power and of might. So the metaphor, there's two sides to it. And here, very obviously, we're not seeing the passive victim side. We're seeing the other side. Now, other scholars, again, have noted as they proceed through this that the most obvious Old Testament source for these first eight verses is Zechariah 6:1 through 8. So I'm going to read that because, again, once I read through it, you'll see again that this is where the obvious points of connection are. Not the only ones, but this is the most obvious. So Zechariah 6 begins this way. Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, four chariots. It's not four horsemen, it's four chariots. Come out from between two mountains. And the mountains were mountains of bronze. And the first chariot had red horses, the second black horses, the third white horses, and the fourth chariot dappled horses, all of them strong. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are going out to the four winds of heaven, after presenting themselves before the Lord of all the earth. The chariot with the black horses goes toward the north country, the white ones go after them, and the dappled ones go toward the south country. And the strong horses came out, and they were impatient to go and patrol the earth." And he said, "Go, patrol the earth." So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried to me, "Behold, those who go toward the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country." It's the end of verses 1 through 8, Zechariah 6. So this is a bit more obscure. I can use that word. I mean, how can anything be more obscure than the book of Revelation? Well, okay, let's try Zechariah on for size. And we've seen, you know, John repurposed passages in Zechariah already. And here he is again. And virtually all Old Testament scholars acknowledge some relationship between the four horses of Zechariah 6 or the four chariots, teams of horses. So they're going to look at those four chariot teams, and they're going to link them back to the teams of horses in Zechariah 1. So the steps go this way. I'm reading Revelation 6. That takes my mind back to Zechariah 6. And Zechariah 6, you know, the precedent for that was Zechariah 1, because there's also chariot teams of horses there. The problem is, while, you know, all Old Testament scholars are going to notice these things, and again, New Testament scholars are going to notice these things too, because the references are, at least on the surface, are pretty obvious. The question is, what's the nature of the relationship between Revelation 6, Zechariah 6, and of course, looping in Zechariah 1? And that is, you know, hotly debated. Ultimately, sort of aligning all three of these passages, Revelation 6, Zechariah 6, Zechariah 1, is peripheral to what we're doing here in the podcast. You can read long sections, pages and pages and pages of how do we reconcile the colors precisely in Revelation 6 with the ones in Zechariah 6? Does dappled mean gray? All this sort of stuff. You know, how do we go from three chariot teams to four, and then to the four individual horse? Look, for our purposes, we don't really need to care about this. There are ways that commentators fix or resolve these issues. They fix these problems. If you want the mathematical resolution to these things and the color palette resolution to these things, again, you can go consult a good exegetical commentary. I would think, though, for our purposes, some general conclusions are more, relevant, more germane. So I'm just going to give you four of them here. The scenes in Zechariah 1 and 6 include an angel figure that may be the angel of Yahweh. Now, we ran into this when we discussed Revelation 1:4. So we might have the angel of the Lord in Zechariah 1 and 6. It's not, can't be completely certain that that's the case, but you can make a case for it. And that's going to matter, when we're looking at Revelation here. In Revelation 6, the four horsemen are unleashed from God's throne, which is an integral element of the divine council scene in Revelation 4 and 5. So let's not lose sight of that. Third, the four horses correspond to the four corners of the earth. In other words, all the earth is under patrol or is going to be affected, in the case of Revelation, negatively. All four corners of the earth, the whole earth, there's going to be an impact here. And that, again, back to the language of Zechariah 6, they're patrolling again. And there are commentators that, some of them would see that as a neutral term. Others would see, well, they're going out with more of a purpose than that. And John, what John says about the purpose, you know, these plagues and whatnot, warfare and death, and all, is not inconsistent with Zechariah 6. Okay, wonderful. All right. We're not going to drill down, or you know, we'd have three or four parts, you know, just looking at each horse individually. You know, I don't want to spend an episode on a horse, you know, four times. There are ways to reconcile these things. But again, we've got possibly the angel of the Lord. We've got the divine counsel element with God's throne. We've got the whole earth, the four corners of the earth affected by this. And fourthly, the horses in Zechariah are actually chariot teams. And the chariots, you know, in the Old Testament context, were instruments of war. So I think it is arguable that the judgment idea is not absent in Zechariah. We'll say that much. The chariot teams are sent out to punish the nations that are oppressing God's people. So if you read Zechariah in context, patrol, what I'm suggesting is, because it's a chariot team, I'm going to be on the side of the commentators that say, you know, if he was just going out for a look, you'd go a single rider on a horse. If you send a chariot, okay, that implies something, you know, violent it implies judgment, because this is an instrument of war. And in the context of Zechariah, that passage is about God avenging his people, God punishing the nations that are oppressing God's people. And that is very much in concert with the flavor of Revelation, even at this point. Because haven't we just read through the letters where God is basically saying, you know, Christ, Jesus is saying, hey, you know, endure to the end, and the Lord knows you're suffering. The Lord knows, you know, those who are persecuting and oppressing you, and he will not forget that. And he, you know, they will have their day. The Lord is not going to let this, you know, pass without, you know, a judgment here. And so this is unleashed in chapter 6. So the contexts are actually, you know, more similar than you'd think. Now, by analogy, again, just to summarize all that, in Revelation 6, we have the Lamb unleashing judgment on the world, four corners, the whole world, by means of the four horsemen. And they are going to punish the world, i.e. those who are oppressing, persecuting the ones who follow the Lamb. Okay, remember Revelation 5, the martyrs, you know, that get the white robes. And this is the context for this. It's very much a day of the Lord kind of feel to it. The Lord is going to avenge his own. Now, if the figure in Zechariah among the myrtles, okay, back to Zechariah here, with these chariot teams is in fact the angel of Yahweh, if that's the case, and again, just go back to where we talked about Revelation 1:4 and 1:5, then by analogy, that would align the angel to Jesus, you know, which of course this is part of the two powers thinking, two powers motif. But it's not. I'm bringing it up not to make an ontological point. Okay, angel of Yahweh, who is Yahweh, that's Jesus. So we've got Godhead language here. Okay, this is well-traversed territory for this podcast. And of course, I spent a lot of time on that Old Testament God as man, the Old Testament theme in Unseen Realm. But I want to make a different point, not an ontological one. The angel of Yahweh did indeed wreak destruction on God's enemies in the Old Testament. Okay. Let's think about what the angel does on occasion. For example, the angel with the drawn sword in his hand at Joshua 5, you know, to precipitate the conquest. Another example is the angel of 1 Chronicles 21 that assaults Jerusalem. Okay, those two scenes, Joshua 5, 1 Chronicles 21, the figure there, the angel of the Lord and the commander, the captain of the Lord's host, they're the same entity. They're the same figure. Again, I've spent a lot of time in Unseen Realm and in other books establishing why this is the case. And the key phrase is the drawn sword in the hand. That phrase is only used three times in Hebrew, as it's written in the Hebrew Bible. And the other two, besides Joshua 5, are absolutely clear angel of the Lord passages. So, you know, we have a correlation here, and you have a warrior, a warrior figure here. Now, I'm going to quote a little bit that I wrote in the Angels book, just, you know, about this. Because this gets looped into other passages, including the destroyer at Passover. So just bear with me here as I summarize some of this material. I wrote in the Angels book, it is clear from both passages, for Joshua 5, 1 Chronicles 21, that the angel of Yahweh is in view and that he brings destruction. Mashkit is a term used in 1 Chronicles 21. Interestingly, this is the identical term used to describe the angel of death in the account of the death of the firstborn on the eve of the first Passover, which reads this. I'm going to read Exodus 12, 13, 21, and 23. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And no plague will befall you to destroy, Mashkit, to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and select lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer, Mashkit, to enter your houses to strike you. The Mashkit, continuing on with what I wrote, who was the angel of Yahweh in 1 Chronicles 21 and the parallel of 2 Samuel 24, is here distinguished by the line, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer, the Mashkit, to enter your houses to strike you. Yet we read elsewhere in other passages that it was Yahweh himself who destroyed the firstborn. So let me just stop there. You look at this again, drawn sword, the Mashkit language, go back to Passover. The Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to enter your houses, the Mashkit. So those are clearly two figures. But yet in other passages, Yahweh is the destroyer. So you have this, again, blending where the destroyer is but isn't Yahweh, you know, this whole two powers thing going on. Here are some of the passages that you know, loop Yahweh into this. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. He struck down all the firstborn in their land, the first fruits of all their strength. For I know that the Lord is great, and that the Lord is above all gods. He it was who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, both man and a beast. So the first passage there was Psalm 105, 26, and 36. Okay, he struck down all the firstborn. He, God, okay. And the second one was, again, he it was who struck down the firstborn of Egypt. Again, the divine name Yahweh is in that passage. That's Psalm 135, 5, and 8. There's another one, Psalm 136, 3 and 10. Give thanks to the Lord of Lords, for his steadfast love endures forever, to him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, for his steadfast love endures forever. So it sure looks like, you know, Yahweh and the destroyer are one and the same, but yet they're different. Again, this two powers thing. Some people have argued, though, that Psalm 78, 48, and 51 complicate this, that it gets in the way. And I'm going to suggest that it really doesn't, but I'm going to read the passage. He, that is Yahweh in context, gave over their cattle to the hail and their flocks to the thunderbolts. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress. A company of destroying angels. The Hebrew is Malakei Ra'im. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but gave their lives over to the plague. He struck down every firstborn in Egypt, the first fruits of their strength in the tents of Ham. So some would say, but oh, you know, God didn't do this destroying. It was this Mashkit who isn't Yahweh, and people will deny the correlations, and then assign the destruction to the quote a company of destroying angels, like to get God off the hook here. The complication is only surface level. Again, in Angels, I wrote the ESV's translation "destroying angels" is somewhat misleading with respect to the terminology we are attempting to trace. The Hebrew term translated "destroying" is not the word Mashkit associated with the destroyer in the passages we looked at earlier. We should also observe that Psalm 78:49 does not say the destroying angels killed the firstborn. It never actually says that. The act is once again attributed to Yahweh in verse 51, okay, of Psalm 78. Yahweh may have sent angels to enact the other plagues, but the death of the firstborn is attributed to him, and of course to the Mashkit, who is the angel of the Lord. These angels, the group of angels, do not act in the role of the destroyer. That is this single figure who is also Yahweh. Now, the point to be taken here, why am I bringing all this up? Again, it's Old Testament context for what we read in Revelation 6. Because here it is not Yahweh or the angel, you know, is it or isn't, you know, the angel of the Lord. I mean, it's the risen Christ. But if you're going back to Zechariah for the parallel, if indeed that is the angel of the Lord, i.e. the destroyer, that would make a lot of sense, because look what the Lamb does in Revelation 6. He unleashes death and plagues and all this sort of stuff. It's kind of interesting, you know, if you start, and we'll do this in a subsequent episode, start to think about the use of the plague imagery for what happens on Earth in Revelation, because there, you know, at one point, you know, you have the Passover lamb slain, and the angel of the Lord is the one destroying, you know, the firstborn. And now, it, as Revelation progresses, as the salvation plan of God progresses, you have the lamb now who is Christ, again, who is also the destroyer. I mean, it's a reversal. It's a folding back of the elements. And now, instead of the people of God, you know, sort of having to kind of duck the plagues here, you know, it's still, you know, God, but now it's again the risen Christ unleashing all this on the enemies of the people of God, and so on and so forth. So there's a parallel, but yet there's also this sort of reversal unfolding of certain of the elements. It's kind of interesting. But anyway, the point for today to be taken here is that in Revelation 6, the slot that would be reserved for either Yahweh or the destroyer, the destroying angel, who is the angel of the Lord, is Jesus. The language here is day of the Lord judgment, and Jesus is not the gentle Savior. He is the destroying judge. And this isn't commonly the way we think about Jesus. I mean, let's just be honest. You know, we often do not, you know, sort of put this, when we think Christology, we don't think of this. But this is part of Christology. I'm not going to rabbit trail too much, but if you're interested, I have put an article in the protected folder. Tremper Longman, who was an Old Testament prof for many years at Westminster Seminary, now he's at, I think it's Westmont in California. Tremper Longman's article, here's the title, The Divine Warrior, The New Testament Use of an Old Testament Motif. It's Westminster Theological Journal back in 1982. It's a really good article because it shows how the New Testament portrayal of Jesus is not just a passive suffering servant, the lamb, the sacrificial victim. There are a lot of passages, and it's not just Revelation 6, that use divine warrior imagery of the risen Christ. And some of it's even like before, you know, you get to Acts and beyond. I mean, there are hints of it. So it's just very interesting, but this is part of Christology. Here in Revelation 6, you know, we don't have the gentle Savior, we have the destroying judge. It's the same person. Now, another question or issue that arises from the opening of the scroll by the Lamb is whether the plagues represented by the four horsemen are sequential or simultaneous. And this is, again, for me anyway, this was interesting enough to park on a little bit because we assume that, and again, in popular prophecy talk, okay, so let's drift over that into that a little bit. We assume a sequence of plagues, you know, this one followed by this one, followed by this one, followed by this one. But there's actually an issue with that. So Beale summarizes the issue of the problem. He writes, the visionary sequence of the four seals being opened could represent sequential occurrences of each disaster, one after another. But more probably, the disasters are simultaneous. This is suggested in that, number one, the fourth seal summarizes the prior three. Number two, the models of Ezekiel 14, 12, and 13, and of course, Zechariah 6, 5, and 8, and the synoptic gospel eschatological discourse, on which Revelation 6, 1 through 8 is also based, portray events of the tribulation occurring simultaneously. Indeed, the synoptic parallels, though fairly uniform, even have different sequences of the trials from Revelation 6, 1 through 11. Number three, the glorified saints in Revelation 6, 9 through 11, we haven't gotten there yet, but we'll just loop this in. They appear to have suffered under all four trials portrayed in the seals. Nevertheless, a logical pattern repeatable throughout the age is discernible. Conquest, first rider, together with civil unrest, especially for persecuted Christians, that's the second rider, leads to famine, the third rider, and death, the fourth rider. Ezekiel 14, 12 through 23 is also formative for this section. We'll get to that momentarily. Ezekiel 14, 21 is explicitly quoted in Revelation 6, 8b, where it functions as a general summary of the preceding trials of conquest, sword, and famine, the first two of which include death. This quotation of Ezekiel also adds one more trial, affliction by beasts. The quoted words have the same function in Ezekiel 14, 21, where they clearly sum up the four preceding statements about trials as, quote, four evil judgments. These punishments come on nations in general when they are unfaithful to God. The trials there are listed respectively as lack of bread and famine, Ezekiel 14:13, wild beasts 14:15, sword 14:17, and death 14:19. The point of Ezekiel 14:21 is that all Israelites will suffer persecution because of rampant idolatry. And the purpose of the trials is to punish the majority of the nation because of its sin, and simultaneously to purify the righteous remnant by the testing of their faith. Now, the point here is that, I mean, let's think about this. You know, when we talked about the scroll itself, we actually did get into this a little bit. And that is, okay, the scroll has seven seals. Just think of a scroll sealed seven times. If you open the first four, you still can't read the scroll. So this notion of, you know, you open one seal and now you can read it, what happens, or now something. In other words, it mars the linear succession idea. And so what Beal is arguing, I mean, we talked about that last time, but he's also bringing it up here. The linear idea of the judgments isn't really a good one. Again, because you have the fourth summarizing the previous three. You've got the synoptic gospels. Some they don't always have the same order. Sometimes they're these summary statements that occur simultaneously. In other words, you may have to wait till all the seals are open for all of this stuff to sort of explode. It's not typically the way we think. And certain eschatological systems, certain end time systems, actually sort of depend on sequencing. Okay, so that's all I'll say there. And it's not really a great argument. So let's go into Revelation 6, 9 through 11. I'll read that. When he appeared, or when he opened the fifth seal, the Lamb, he opens the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God, and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been. Bit ominous, but let's just pick our way through a few things. Under the altar, Revelation 6, 9, what's the altar? What is the meaning of altar? Now, there's two possibilities here. You know, On comments on this, but he doesn't really commit himself to either possibility, but I'll read what he says anyway. He says, since in Jewish thought the earthly temple was modeled after the heavenly temple, it is appropriate to ask to what the eight occurrences of the term altar in the book of Revelation refer. The tabernacle and the Solomonic temple and the Herodian temple had two distinct altars. There was the outer altar or the altar of burnt offering located along with the bronze laver in the court before the entrance to the holy place, i.e., in the court of the priests. That's Josephus's language. And the inner altar or the golden altar of incense situated just in front of the parochet or curtain, separating the holy place or nave from the devir, the most holy place, Leviticus 4:18. So you've actually got two altars here, but he doesn't really land anywhere. Now, Beal does a little bit more with this. So I'm going to share what he writes. He says, the mention of the altar here in association with those slain evokes the sacrificial nature of their suffering. This altar is not the brazen altar of sacrifice, although the sacrificial blood was poured out at the base of that altar. Leviticus 4:18, verse 30 and verse 34. And in Revelation 6:10, the sacrificed saints are under the altar. Also see Leviticus 17:11, the blood sprinkled on this altar is said to have the nephesh of the flesh, the life of the flesh in it. The better identification, Beal thinks, is with the golden altar of incense, which stood in the vicinity of the Holy of Holies. This is clearly referred to in Revelation 8:3 and through 5, and Revelation 9:13, and in the developments of those references in Revelation 11:1, 14:18, and 16:17, or 16:7, excuse me, the sacrificial blood of the Day of Atonement was poured on that altar, and incense was burned on it. Exodus 30:1-10, Leviticus 4:7, and Hebrews 9:4. The saints, Beal says, are strangely under the altar instead of on it. This may allude merely to blood running down to the base of the altar after having been poured on its top, but what is more probably in mind is the association or virtual equation in both Revelation and Jewish writings of this altar with the throne of God, whose sovereign purposes ultimately protect the saints. Therefore, placing the saints under the altar emphasizes the divine protection that has held sway over their souls, despite even their loss of physical life because of persecution. So let me just, that's the end of his quote, but he's angling for altar of incense because of its proximity to the throne, i.e. the Ark of the Covenant behind the veil in the Old Testament. And also because in other references to the altar in the book of Revelation, it's more clearly the altar of incense. And so Beale, again, he's landing there and he's again, doing some extrapolation here of what the imagery might convey. And in this case, it's the ultimate protection. You know, if the saints are under this particular altar, the altar of incense right outside the curtain, you know, where God's throne is, it seems to be the best match. Well, then what that would speak to is that even if you lose your physical life, you're still going to be with the Lord. Okay, that kind of thing. So that this is where Beale angles toward and where he lands. And I'm persuaded by that only because of the subsequent references to the altar more clearly being the altar of incense. So that would make sense to me. And again, what John is doing here is he's assuming a certain amount of knowledge of the temple furnishings and where they're situated. And again, kind of ritual procedure in the Old Testament. He's repurposing that to equate it with the throne that he's described in Revelation 4 and 5, where the Lamb is. I mean, the Lamb's not enthroned yet, but the Lamb is in the presence of the Lord. And so judgment is going out from this location, and it's simultaneously the same location where the souls of the faithful are still there. They're there in the presence of God, and they're given white robes, and yes, you're going to be with the Lord forever. So it's this, he's using the imagery to create both a judgment context, that judgment is coming out from the one who has authority, ultimately the one who has the keys of death and Hades. You know, if Jesus is in control of death and Hades now, and he is, because John has just made that point a few chapters earlier, then he gets to decide the severity of the judgment and where the final destination of those judged is going to be. And if you're on his side, yes, even if you lose your physical life in the wake of all this upheaval, this chaos, this apocalyptic stuff, be assured that the Lord knows who you are and you will be with him. That's the messaging. And John is using Old Testament imagery to communicate those ideas. Now, for the white robe in Revelation 6:11, you could just see our discussion back in Revelation 3:4. We're not going to say any more about that with the white robe imagery and some of the other stuff that goes with it. Let's move to 6:12 through 17. I'll read the passage. John writes, "When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth, and the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth, as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, 'Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb.'" There you go again with the one on the throne and the Lamb distinguished. "For the great day of their wrath, there's two of them, has come, and who can stand?" Now this section amalgamates a number of Old Testament passages. This is where John is just throwing everything into the blender again. You know, Beale writes, "The judgment of the world is depicted with stock in trade Old Testament imagery for the dissolution of the cosmos. This portrayal is based on a mosaic of Old Testament passages that are brought together because of the cosmic metaphors of judgment that they have in common. The quarry of texts," it's a nice line, "from which the description has been drawn is composed primarily of," here's the grocery list, "Isaiah 13, 10 through 13, Isaiah 24, 1 through 6, Isaiah 24, 19 through 23, Isaiah 34, 4, Ezekiel 32, 6 and 8, Joel 2, 10, Joel 2, 30 and 31, Joel 3, 15 and 16, and Habakkuk 3, 6 to 11. And then Beale notes, you might get some allusions to Amos 8, 8, 9, Jeremiah 4, 23 through 28, and Psalm 68, 7. I mean, it, like I said, John's throwing everything into the blender here. "These same Old Testament texts," Beale writes, "are also influential in Matthew 24, 29, Mark 13, 24, and 25, and Acts 2, 19, and 20, which also quotes Joel 2, 30, and 31. In other words, the same, to use Beale's phrase, the same quarry, okay, that John is mining all of these Old Testament passages from. Okay, they all have apocalyptic flavoring in the Old Testament. They're not only repurposed here in what John's doing in Revelation 6, but they get repurposed in synoptic gospel, apocalyptic passages, and the book of Acts, you know, discussion. This is Acts 2, 19 through 20, you know, about the inauguration, you know, of the new covenant, the coming of the Holy Spirit, and so on and so forth. So all of these things are sort of just thrown into the blender. And Beale later observes, quote, the most formative influences among these texts, and this is a point of interest for those of you who are, again, familiar with Unseen Realm context, is Isaiah 34:4, after which Revelation 6, 13 and 14 has most closely been patterned, unquote. And you say, well, what's the big deal? Go back to Isaiah 34:4. Let's just read the whole thing. We'll read verses 1 through 4. Because this is where you get both the judgment of the powers on the earth and also the powers in the heavens, okay, the spiritual world. Isaiah 34, starting in verse 1, draw near, O nations, to hear, and give attention, O peoples. Let the earth hear and all that fills it, the world and all that comes from it. For the Lord is enraged against all the nations and furious against all their host. That's a key phrase, their host. So God is angry at the nations, and he's angry at their host. He has devoted them to destruction, which is the Karem language of the conquest back in the days of Moses and Joshua. He has given them over for slaughter. Their slain shall be cast out. The stench of their corpses shall rise. The mountains shall flow with their blood. All the host of heaven shall rot away. All the skies roll up like a scroll. All, there it is again, their host shall fall. As leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. So that verse 4, all the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their host shall fall, as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from a fig tree. Now, if you're in my Unseen Realm class at the Awakening School, I know, you know, this is going to be familiar because we actually spent some time in a class period on it, but I'll give you the quick version here. And I mention it, I believe, I don't know if I mentioned this in Unseen Realm, it might be another book, but if you do a search for Tsevaam, their host, it's just the word Tseva, you know, Lord of Hosts is Tsevaot, you know, Adonai Tsevaot, Lord of Hosts. The singular is Tseva, refers to an army or a group or, you know, the host of heaven, celestial objects. But Tsevaam is that word with, again, a plural suffix, their host, attached to it. If you do a search specifically on that word form with that suffix, every time it's used in the Hebrew Bible, it speaks of celestial objects, not earthly armies. Every time. So Isaiah 34, again, we have here in the Septuagint, the powers, the dunamis. Yeah, it's a word, that, again, that Paul's going to use for supernatural powers of darkness. The powers of the heavens will melt, and the heaven will be rolled up like a scroll, and all the stars will fall, as leaves fall from a fig tree. Over in Revelation 6, 13 and 14, you know, John is going to be using the Septuagint, or, you know, at least it looks that way. He says, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs, when shaken by a great wind, and the heaven was split as a scroll having been rolled up. So he draws a little bit from Isaiah 34, and he's going to be looping other passages into it. But it's very clear that he's thinking about celestial catastrophe. And again, the celestial language in Old Testament thought and Second Temple Jewish thought is not always, but frequently used of supernatural powers. And that is certainly the way that Isaiah 34:4 is using this, because it adds this thought to, again, the human armies earlier in the passage. It's very clear that God is going to judge both. At the day of the Lord, the human powers oppressing the people of God are going to get what's coming to them, and so are the spiritual powers going to get what's coming to them. You know, the phrase stars fell from heaven, that is in Revelation 6:13. That's, you can look that up in Matthew 24, 29, Mark 13, 25. I mean, Isaiah 34, verse 4, plays an important role here. Because, you know, we read, it's easy to read through this passage. And again, lots of end time systems do this, the ones that want to see black helicopters and all this. They're only thinking about earthly armies. And again, what I'm saying is, well, some of the language just goes beyond that. But let's not forget that element. So the observation for our purposes is because the Septuagint of Isaiah 34:4 translates the Hebrew "all their host" Tsevaam with dunamis, a term that can describe a, I'll just quote a lexicon here so people know that I'm not making up. This is Artin Gingrich. Dunamis is a term that can describe, quote, a personal transcendent spirit or heavenly agent, unquote. Again, because this language in the Greek includes that semantic, and because he's drawing specifically on Isaiah 34:4, when you go to Revelation 6:13 and 14, he talks about the stars of heaven falling. He's not talking about an asteroid catastrophe. Okay, we're not talking about something NASA can defeat. Again, dispense with the uber literalism. We're talking about the judgment of cosmic powers of darkness, along with suffering and apocalyptic violence on the earth. These two things go together, folks. This is the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. This is the Daniel 10 worldview. Okay, the powers on earth, behind them are other supernatural powers that are using them, manipulating them, steering things to the ends to which they want. If in Revelation we're describing the judgment of human powers that are persecuting believers, you would think that John wouldn't leave out the judgment of, again, the fallen gods of the Old Testament, the corrupt sons of God, Psalm 82, the princes of the nations, Daniel 10. And what I'm suggesting to you is he's not leaving it out. He knows it, he sees it, and by virtue of his allusions here, he's tracking with it. And this is, you know, we need to be a little more careful in what we read. Now, I want to say a little more about the falling stars language. This is language used in the Second Temple period in Second Temple Jewish literature of supernatural powers in rebellion. You find this elsewhere. That's not just the Septuagint of Isaiah 34:4. You know, for instance, you've got, I'm just a list of references in First Enoch. We'll just use Enoch. You know, we could go beyond Enoch, but here it is. First Enoch 18:13, 21:3, 46:7, 86:3, 88:3, 90:21. All of these use the phrasing about falling stars of the watchers, okay, supernatural powers in rebellion, or again, the fallen, you know, gods of the nations, however we want to say that. Nicholsburg, in his commentary on First Enoch, says this about First Enoch 86:3. He says, in First Enoch 86:1-3, stars are an image for the watchers. And in Daniel 12:3 and 1 Enoch 104:2, stars and angels may even be identified with one another. An extremely close connection is indicated in 1 Enoch 82:4-20. Thus, when 1 Enoch 18:15 speaks of transgressing stars, it is alluding to a variation on the myth of the rebellion of the watchers. Okay, that's Nicholsburg. You know what? You also get wandering star language in the New Testament, do you not? Wandering stars is not, you know, something, again, that, well, I hope NASA noticed that. No, it's language that describes supernatural powers in rebellion, enemies of the people of God. So let's not forget that. You know, Isaiah 34, again, really hits on both of these things. It's an important juxtaposition describing an eschatological judgment that includes the gods of the nations akin to Psalm 82, along with, you know, human powers. So in light of all this, again, it's unwise to assume that what John describes in Revelation 6:13-14 is a meteor shower, near-Earth asteroid impact, or some other literal astronomical cataclysm. The judgment of the powers may in fact be the intended meaning. Now, Beale, again, you know, Beale's not doing anything deliberately divine counsel, okay? But he actually notes this possibility in his own defense of not reading the content of these verses, you know, overly literally. He writes this. He says, the reference to stars, mountains, and islands as symbols of human or divine powers in the Septuagint, the Jewish writings, and the Apocalypse itself would point further to a figurative interpretation. I would agree. Although I like metaphorical better, because figurative makes it seem like, yeah, I think a word like figurative for evangelical readers puts it, makes it fall into that category. Well, if it's figurative, it's not real then. No, it is. Okay, a metaphor depends. Its coherence depends on something that is, you know, literally real. So, you know, when you get language like this, we have to remember that when scripture uses metaphorical, symbolic, you know, we'll use the word figurative here to be nice, you know, figurative language, the point is not that we're talking about something less than real. We're talking about something more than real in a physical earthly sense. Okay? Got to keep that in mind. One final note on the altar is in order. As was the case with the 24 elders, there exists, believe it or not, an astral interpretation of this feature. On, in his Revelation commentary, actually alerts readers to this point, even though he's not going to buy it, but he at least does it. He writes, Bull, he's referencing other scholars, you know, everybody except Malina is written in German, okay? Bull, Sattler, and Malina remind us that there was a constellation called the Altar, located in the southern sky in the Milky Way. And then he quotes, you know, a few, you know, Greek and Latin, you know, classical texts, you know, Ptolemy, Hipparchus, Eudoxus, so on and so forth. And they, you know, get going down here to what he says here a little bit further. Bull considered the souls clothed in white under the altar to be the stars in the Milky Way, over which the altar constellation is situated. Let me just stop there. Isn't that interesting? You know, you've got in the astronomical interpretation or the astral interpretation, you've got the altar, and underneath it, you've got a series of stars. And stars, of course, is going to be used elsewhere, both in the Bible and outside the Bible, for celestial beings and or believers who have been glorified. You know, just pointing it out. You know, it's at least on the table here. So Bull considered the souls clothed in white under the altar to be the stars in the Milky Way over which the altar constellation is situated. So in Bull's mind, John is using astral imagery to communicate the same point, you know, about, you know, believers are secure, they're going to be glorified, they're going to be with the Lord, they're going to be part of the council. I mean, the theological endpoints are the same. It's just, what is the metaphorical strategy for communicating the idea? And Bull and Malina and others opt for the astral interpretation. They think that the metaphors are astral in nature. But that's all, you know, we're saying here. It's just that this perspective is quite neglected when it comes to Revelation commentaries. Obviously, there are exceptions, which is why we're reading this stuff. So he continues, he says, you know, On isn't buying this. This interpretation seems forced, however, since the altar mentioned here in verse 9 is one of the furnishings of the heavenly temple referred to elsewhere in Revelation. And astral deification is not so much as hinted at in the rest of Revelation, although it is certainly known in Jewish apocalyptic. Well, you know, there's a problem here. There's actually two problems here. Owen's opinion that this option seems forced is inconsistent with his own content. I mean, we've quoted him here in prior episodes. The very citation, the very quote I just read you, notes that the temple is heavenly. Okay. Which raises the question as to why the altar could not also be heavenly. It's a heavenly temple, a heavenly altar. Don't they kind of go together? In addition, Daniel 12, 1 through 3 has already been used by John, and those verses do indeed point to deification or identification of the righteous with the stars and therefore with the celestial council. And Owen's been all over that. So he's a little bit internally inconsistent here. It seems strained to presume that John needs to keep repeating the idea with the same words for it to be legitimate. But I guess that's what Owen needs to feel a little more positive toward it. But anyway, at least he brings it up. I mean, to his credit, he brings it up. Others do not. And again, for my money, it's at least on the tables. You know, the question again, going back to what I said a few minutes ago, is, you know, your theological endpoints are the same. It's just which metaphor or metaphors is John drawing on? You know, to communicate this set of ideas? Is it astral or is it something else? And again, I agree. If you think way back to the very first episode we did on introducing, you know, the Old Testament Revelation, I think it was the first episode when I mentioned Malina. Whenever I did that for the first time, I agree with criticisms of his work that he neglects looking for solutions in the Old Testament. That is certainly a flaw. But that doesn't mean that we have to choose between one or the other. It's not an A or a B. Do I choose Old Testament antecedents and metaphors and symbols and, you know, verses? Or, you know, do I choose astral stuff, astral metaphors and Second Temple stuff that uses that kind of content? Do I choose one or the other? It's not a both and, it's an either or. Or excuse me, it's not an either or, it's a both and. You know, John could be doing both at the same time. He could be moving from one to the other. There's no cosmic rule that says we have to pick a pile. And honestly, there never is. Okay, so we need to have all these things on the table and take a look at them and then just ask ourselves, well, you know, what are the possibilities John could be using this or that or the other thing or combination thereof, or, you know, a lot of this stuff, you know, is floating through his mind, and he's just, you know, he's picking freely, you know, in the way he describes things, you know. And again, this is not to say that John, you know, didn't see certain things. He's recording things that he did see, but it's not like he's writing this stuff, you know, while he's in a trance. That's what he says at the very beginning. I was in the spirit in the Lord's day. Okay. If that's the case, then this is in part, at least in part, a recollection, and John is trying to communicate what he saw. And so he's also trying to add meaning to what he saw. He's trying to connect with his readers, you know, so that they will understand the implications of what he saw. So it could be, again, we just have to read what he's produced for us in the book of Revelation with all of these things at our disposal. That's my only argument. They should all be on the table. We shouldn't be required or forced to only play in one sandbox as opposed to the other. Just don't see any point to that. But anyway, I would just cautiously suggest, as we wrap up here, that if Revelation 4 and 5 is describing glorified believers being part of the divine council, or at least includes that idea, again, we've spent a lot of time on Revelation 4 and 5, then an astral point of reference could be another layer in John's thinking. While isolating the meaning to Revelation's altar to astral thinking goes too far, you know, Malin is guilty of that, the same can be said for eliminating that possibility altogether. So again, we're going to be doing more of this as we proceed, because there are going to be places where astral stuff might really lend, you know, give us some help here, might really lend some clarity, if we can even use the word clarity of Revelation for basically anything. I'll go back to help. It might help us a little bit. Clarity seems a little too bold. All these things should be on the table. So that's Revelation 6. Again, obviously dipping into Old Testament stuff with not, you know, specific reference, you know, to altar, Zechariah's horses and chariots and all this stuff. But he's also, you know, referencing Old Testament concepts like celestial judgment of the fallen gods. Okay. Like the divine warrior who now is the Lamb. Okay, all of these things are drawn from the Old Testament. They frame what John is trying to communicate and describe in terms of, you know, what he was shown. And so the more of this kind of stuff we know, the more apt we will be to not try to parse these things in light of our own modern metaphors or in light of our own modern expectations. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a wise thing, because Revelation was written to a specific audience at a specific time. You know, let's just call it the first century, you know, looping in both date possibilities here. And the people who are reading it need to understand it. Those are the ones that it was written to. They, whatever we say is going on in the text, the people of the first century need to be able to parse this. It's a simple idea. Reading the text in context, and all of these things we've talked about today are part of that context. Lots of things to draw on, and John doesn't limit himself, and so neither should we.
If only there was an astral prophecy book that we could help us understand. Gosh. If only, you know,
you're getting a bit of it here.
If only there
is maybe the only way it ever gets.
I don't know how many hints I have to drop here to get that thing produced, but all right. Yeah. Well, hey, next time, it seems like we're going to be dealing with the 144,000. It seems like you've tackled that before, maybe in a Q&A or something, but
yeah, we have dipped into it, and that can be pretty dense. I'm not going to promise just one part there, but we'll try. Okay. Reversing Hermon gets into this a little bit, you know, with the tribe of Dan being omitted and all that stuff. So I'm betting that's probably going to take us two times, but we'll see.
All right. Sounds good. We'll be looking forward to it. With that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.